Hello and welcome to the Movie Bunker podcast with me, Matt.
Hey, it's me, Chris.
And today we're joined by Chris Hewitt. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Chris. It's Chris.
this might get confusing later on when I ask Chris a question.
We're all on lockdown and we're scrambling around for
guests. for guests. Eventually, the bottom of the barrel has been scraped.
Chris, thanks for coming on. I know these difficult times, it's very difficult to know what to do from day to day, but I appreciate you coming on into the virtual bunker. But you've chosen what will be considered to be, on a lot of people's lists, not a bunker movie. But what's the movie you've chosen to talk about today?
Well, eventually, after much back and forth, the movie that I have chosen, I can't even remember the first movie I nominated, but the movie I have chosen is Stephen Norrington's 1998 classic, Blade.
Oof. Cue techno music and blood raining from the ceiling.
You better wake up. The world you live in is just a sugar-coated topper. There is another world beneath it. The real world.
For thousands of years, they have existed among us.
You keep your eyes open. They're everywhere. Chances are you've seen them yourself and didn't know it.
A secret nation.
Our livelihood depends on our ability to blend in.
With a lust for power.
We should be ruling the humans. These people are our food.
They've got their claws into everything. Politics, finance, real estate.
There's a war going on out there.
He makes the weapons. I use them.
Now, one will lead them to conquer mankind.
Tonight, the age of man comes to an end.
We're gonna be gods.
And one will try to stop him dead.
There are worse things out tonight than vampires.
Like what?
Like me.
Half human.
Blade's mother was attacked by a vampire while she was pregnant.
Half immortal.
You got the best of both worlds. All our strengths. None of our weaknesses.
He is their greatest fear and our only hope.
It's open season on all vampires.
Wesley Snipes. Stephen Dorff.
You're one of them, aren't you?
No. I'm something else.
Blade.
Well, this was one of the most earliest Marvel outings. Is it made by Marvel Studios or not quite?
Well, Marvel Studios, yeah, they didn't become an entity until as of the Marvel Cinematic Universe back in 2008. But yeah, it certainly paved the way. So one of the reasons I chose Blade is not just because I think it is a fantastic film and I am prepared to defend it to the death or to at least to the mild wounding, but also because I think it's the movie that started it all. You know, this where we are today, not where we are right now with the coronavirus, that's not Blade's fault, but the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the dominance of superheroes on the big screen can all be traced back to Blade. Most people think it was traced back to X-Men in 2000, but without Blade's success, there is no X-Men. Without X-Men, there is no Spider-Man. Without Spider-Man, there is no Daredevil, and so on and so forth until we get to the MCU.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier on today, weren't we, Matt, about the fact that you kind of coined the phrase, this is the saviour of Marvel in a way.
I mean, when you first suggested this, when you said Chris wanted to do this film, I'm like, it's not, it can't possibly be lower rating that. But then finding out that it was 55% on Rotten Tomatoes, I was shocked. I was beside myself and then instantly excited as we get to talk about what I think to be is a very good film, and nowhere near a 55% at.
So what was it that caused the problems for the critics when it was released?
That's a very, very good question. I wasn't a critic when this was released, so I knew very little about this movie when it was released. I actually got press-ganged into going to see this in Belfast by a good friend of mine who'd already seen it and knew it would be right up my street because it had incredible fight scenes, it had lots of violence, lots of bloodthirstiness. I wasn't necessarily even aware it was a comic book movie. I was a big comic book guy back then, but Blade had somehow passed me by. I'm especially a big Marvel Comics guy, but Blade had passed me by. So I was only dimly aware of it, and I went to see it, and it absolutely blew me away. But in terms of the critical reception, I think it's a kind of movie that's very, very easy to dismiss, especially towards the tail end of the 90s. It's based on a comic book, so at the tail end of the 90s, that meant chintzy, that meant something that could be easily written off. You know, this is a year after Batman and Robin, the low point of comic book adaptations. So it was probably tarred with that brush as well. And it was a big, on the surface anyway, dumb action movie. So it was very, very easy for people to dismiss. But its credentials as an action movie, I think, are what keeps it relevant and keeps it current. It's a fantastic movie in that respect. And of course, we'll get onto it later, I'm sure, paved the way for David S. Goyer's career.
I'm looking down at his writing credits now. A lot of people obviously know him from The Dark Knight Rises and sort of all of the sort of later Batman films, but he's a bit hit and missy, though, because like for every Batman Begins, you've got a jumper.
Yeah, hit and miss is exactly the right way to describe David Goyer, in that he wrote Blade, he wrote Blade 2, he directed Blade Trinity, which you could argue is the true nadir for the comic book movie in so many ways, and certainly killed this character, killed this franchise stone dead, one of the worst comic book movies of all time. And yet he managed to write these two movies. The first, the Blade and Blade 2, I think are both fantastic films. And yeah, he's a bit all over the shop, it has to be said. But this is a really, really solid, very, very cool script.
But his executive producer writes... and credentials as well are fantastic. Yeah, as you say, Blade 2, Freddy versus Jason, he's a screenwriter on Ghost Rider, which we've done in the podcast. But that's a brilliant film though, isn't it? Let's face it. Definitely puts in the splatter category. But so yeah, he's got a very varied career in terms of success. But the director hasn't done much at all, has he?
No, Stephen Norrington was a music video guy. He's a British guy, and he directed this, and then he tried to get The Crow off the ground, and then 5 years after Blade, he made a little film called The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Ooh.
Perhaps one day we'll do that on this podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
Because that is the movie that's shoot was so tumultuous that not only did Sean Connery retire afterwards, so did its director. So Stephen Norrington hasn't directed a movie since, and... I was lucky enough to be given his email address by a mutual acquaintance once, and I emailed him a couple of times trying to get something off the ground, and he responded both times. I've since lost it, but he responded both times saying he was very flattered, but that he was maintaining radio silence and that he'd gone off the grid. So as far as I'm aware, he hasn't directed anything since League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is a real shame, because as bad as that movie is, he's got a real eye and he's got real talent. And there's something about Blade that stands out from a visual point of view. You know, it's a movie, I'm just looking here, it came out the same year, weirdly enough, as Dark City, and which is also a David S. Goyer script. And it's a movie that feels very original from a visual standpoint. There was nothing else like it back in 1998. And there's really still nothing else like it in the comic book world.
I remember when I first watched it being absolutely blown away by the way that just like the visually, the way the vampires would just like disintegrate, and
yeah,
just the sort of the pacing of the sort of cutscenes, you know, the time lapsing and the sort of very unnerving kind of way that the vampire characters would just change position without any sort of, you know, movement between them and stuff. Mm, yeah, yeah, it was just stunning to watch.
Would you also say, I mean, it's one of those, a precursor to, I don't want to say Deadpool, but it's because of the violence, the gore and the swearing. It was kind of like the first, is it 18? It wouldn't have been 18, it's a 15, I would have guessed, would it?
It would have been, it was an 18, yeah.
It was an 18, wow. So it's kind of like, it's quite bold in terms of those decisions to put that much swearing, gore and, you know, effing and jeffing and stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the interesting things. Evan and Jeffin are my two favorite characters in the movie, by the way. And but it's absolutely mad when you think about it. I mean, this is a movie that Marvel Entertainment, I think, is what it was called back then, and it essentially was Avi Arad, who went on to produce the likes of Spider-Man and whatnot. And I'm not sure if Kevin Feige was on the scene at this point, but he was in and around. I think Kevin Feige came on with X-Men in 2000. But it was Avi Arad, and you know, Marvel was really small business back then. I mean, you know, the stories of how Marvel completely and utterly messed up their the movie side of their business and missed open goals and sold off key properties to studios all over Hollywood so that they couldn't do a shared universe for years and years and years, and still have problems in that regard. Our legion, those stories are absolutely legion, how they just didn't, however, whoever was in charge of Marvel at the time just didn't get that there was a gold mine here just waiting to be mined. So when they eventually did get a movie, I mean, they'd been trying with Spider-Man. Spider-Man had been mooted for years. There's the famous James Cameron scriptment that's still knocking around the internet if you know where to look. And they'd been trying for years to get things off the ground. And the thing they get off the ground first is an R-rated horror thriller with incredible action scenes and years ahead of its time with an African-American lead as well. And that's the thing that leads to X-Men, which, as I said before, then begets Spider-Man and so on. Then they go family-friendly. Then they go PG-13. Then they jettison all the effing and the jeffing and the blood and the violence and the guts and the gore. But they kind of had it first time out. And, you know, so whenever everyone goes, Deadpool's the king of the R-rated superhero movie, it's like, well, he was beaten to the punch back in 1998. And then after that, with the Punisher and Punisher Warzone. But yeah, Blade is where it all began.
And do you think they're going to come back sort of full circle with this character when they eventually, I guess, get it off the ground again with the reboot?
Yeah, which I'm intrigued by. You know, this is the great question of the Marvel Cinematic Universe now that they've got the Fox properties back on board, and now that they do have Deadpool, is will they embrace an R rating at some point, which is something that the DC Extended Universe has shown absolutely no qualms about doing, you know, with Suicide Squad and Birds of Prey and Joker. They don't care, you know, whatever the certificate needs to be for the movie, they will do. And the box office shows that people don't really care that much. They'll go to see it in droves if it's, well, I was going to say if it's good enough, but Suicide Squad's terrible and it nearly made a billion. But I think the question is, if Deadpool's on board and people know him as an R-rated character, will they go down that route with Deadpool? And Blade is on board and people know him as an R-rated character because of how far Blade and Blade 2 in particular push it. And Blade 3, for all its faults, has one of the best examples of swearing in the history of cinema. Can I say the C word?
Yeah, oh yes.
You know, when Ryan Reynolds calls Parker Posey a cock-juggling thunder cunt. And,
you know,
this line.
So it'll be interesting to see whether that comes back in Blade. I somehow can't imagine someone in the Marvel Cinematic Universe turning to Steve Rogers or whoever is still alive at that point and calling him a thunder cunt. But you never know. It might be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, it's a great phrase. I must use that tomorrow when I'm teaching the kids. I've been calling them Mewling Quins for years. They've never really understood that. This has got quite a decent cast as well. I mean, I've never seen Kris Kristofferson on screen in anything prior really? Or since to this movie. But so what has he been in that I've missed?
Okay, so obviously he's primarily known for his music. But yeah, he's been in all sorts of stuff. He worked with Sam Peckinpah a bunch of times, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. I grew up loving him in Convoy. He's in one of the many Star is Born remakes. He's in the one with Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just one of those guys. Like Heaven's Gate. He was in Heaven's Gate as well, which might have, you know, maybe put the old acting thing, knocked it on the head for a little bit as well. But he's been in tons of stuff. He was in John Sayles' Lone Star, which is a great film if you haven't seen that. But there's something about him in Blade as Whistler. There's just something about him. He's really, really impactful. Whether he's, you know, playing himself a sort of ornery old kind of, you know, Texas, you know, carved from rock kind of guy. But he's just tremendous in this, to the point where he's one of those characters that when they kill him off, the film does lose something.
Yeah.
You know, even if it is a sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of cliched mentor role, the film really does lose something. It's so much so that they brought him back for Blade 2. and then again in Blade 3, where they actually killed him this time and it stuck. But yeah, he's really good. He really looks the part.
Yeah, definitely. Udo Kier is in this as well, if I've pronounced his surname.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
What did we watch recently, Matthew, with Udo in it, which was brilliant? I can't remember.
We don't watch very many brilliant things, to be fair, Chris.
No, but he was in a crap film.
He's been
not rediscovered because he's kind of this camp icon, Udo Kier, in many ways. And he was in S. Craig Soller. S. Craig Soller is one of the people who's rediscovered him recently. And he's cast him in Brawl in Cell Block 99 and then Dragged Across Concrete. He's in both movies. And he's absolutely chilling in Brawl in Cell Block 99. He's absolutely chilling in that. But his casting here is a little bit of a kind of inside joke because he's played Dracula. And, you know, he's got a very vampiric look as well.
So yeah, they saved a fortune on makeup.
They really did. They really did. And of course, Pearl, the giant vampire blob thing, she plays herself. She was just hanging around one day and they went, do you mind being in the film? And lo and behold, there she is.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant. She was a background actor, but we've seen it just before.
She was the background.
Don't miss her. Stephen Dorff, I just want to talk about him for a second, because is he the weakest link in terms of the casting and the villain in this, do you think?
Oh. Where did this really place in his career, though? Was this when he's on the way up? Or
yeah, big time. Big, well, ish. Well, no.
But
this is I don't know, this is maybe, so I'm just looking here, he had done Backbeat a few years earlier. He's a good actor, Stephen Dorff. You know, it's not easy to do a Liverpoolian accent, but he does it very well in Backbeat. So he'd been in things like Judgment Night and SFW. But looking at his credits in 1995 and 1996, so he did Space Truckers for the great Stuart Gordon, who just passed, of course. He did Blood and Wine, the Nicholson movie as well with Michael Caine. So he was kind of, he hadn't had that big breakout hit. I think he was probably more beloved of the tabloids and perhaps more of a thing with his fan base than he was maybe within the consciousnesses of the American movie going public. But I certainly knew who he was, and he's a very, very cool dude. And I think he really holds his own with Wesley Snipes in this movie. We haven't even mentioned Wesley Snipes yet, but well, I'm sure we'll get to that. You could do 4 hours on Wesley Snipes from the stories I heard and can't repeat.
But he's
certainly an interesting fella. But I think Deacon Frost is really, really cool. He's kind of the antithesis of Blade in so many, many ways. He's not called Eric for a start, which helps. And Dorff's really cool in this.
Okay, I'll let you have that one. But Donald Logue.
I'm defending this movie to the death, I told you.
Donald Logue is brilliant in this as well. Isn't he in pretty much every movie of this kind of ilk?
He is, but this is the first time I saw him in something, and obviously he was in Gotham, so I guess all roads eventually lead to another comic book movie or another comic book TV show or something like that. I remember him then after this, he was in the Tao of Steve, which was a very small Sundance-y type movie which came out in around early 2000s, something like that. But he's just one of those guys. I mean, he's in Ghost Rider. but he's just really fun in this as kind of the secondary henchman, if you will, you know. So in a very Bondy and very, very Batman-esque way, there's a main bad guy and there's a secondary bad guy, and the way he gets taken out at the end is deeply, deeply cool. And they riff on it a little bit in Blade 2. You know, they kind of try and pull the same trick with Ron Perlman, but because it's Guillermo del Toro and because it's Ron Perlman, they subvert it a little bit. But yeah, Donald Logue is really, really cool. He's very sleazy in this. If I'm right in thinking, first time we see him, he's getting a blowjob.
Yes.
That's a way to start. That's a way to be introduced to an audience.
The amount of times he escapes death in this film is insane. Even when he first is like pinned to the wall by Blade, there's a reference to the fact that, like, how many times after, so he's like, not only does he survive an inappropriate amount of time during the film itself, but it's clear from the backstory that he survived much longer than he should have done anyway. So I was surprised at how long he lived in this film more than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. He's the embodiment in a way. Like, the vampires in this movie are, well, listen, everything in this movie is really cool. Really, really, really cool. But there's a real rock and roll aesthetic. I get the sense of Stephen Norrington, who actually cameos in the film. So there's a moment where it's one of those kind of establishing shots where the camera's moving a little bit fast, and there's an establishing shot on a street corner, and you see a vampire with really long hair taking a bite out of a woman's neck, and he's in the foreground. That's Stephen Norrington. And the sense I always got was that Stephen Norrington didn't have to have any hair extensions or the aesthetic of this movie is very much his aesthetic. He's very much into rock and roll. He's very much into metal. And therefore that's very much reflected in most of the characters. I would say Quinn and Whistler in particular.
That opening sequence spawned an actual hit song, didn't it? Record? Like the Blade in the Place, that whole bloodbath disco scene actually had its own.
Is it Black Lace? Did they do something with it? And...
Isn't that Agadoo?
I'm pretty sure. I think you watched a very different cut to what I saw.
They did Superman, didn't they? Or am I thinking
Oh, I'd love to see that opening scene soundtrack to Agadoo now. That'd be fantastic. Yeah, the opening track. I mean, techno is not my my cup of tea at all, and it's not my forte. So I am reliably informed that the opening track is a New Order remix. It's Confusion, the Pump Panel Reconstruction Mix, to be precise.
You're going to have to seek that one out to do the dishes with tomorrow, Matt.
Well, you can't sing it. You can't hum along, can you? That's my idea of good music.
Shall we move on to old Big Old Wesley then?
Big Old Wesley?
Yeah.
Big Old Wesley.
Because at the time, I guess this would have, he was just absolute box office draw, wasn't he, around this sort of time?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I would say he was maybe... It's interesting. I would say he was maybe a little on the wane.
Okay.
Which is a strange thing to say, because that year he headlined... two big action movies. U.S. Marshals, the beloved and superior sequel to The Fugitive, came out in 1998, starring, of course, Robert Downey Jr., whatever happened to him, and the once and former Two-Face, Tommy Lee Jones, of course. But I think Wesley's kind of... Wesley, I've never met him, but Wesley's apex as a leading man kind of came a few years earlier, around about the time of Passenger 57, Rising Sun with Sean Connery, Demolition Man. Those are 1992, 1993, thereabouts. The Fan hadn't done that well in 1996. Murdered 1600 hadn't done that well in 1997. So he was perhaps a little on the way out. Even the film he made with Woody Harrelson again, you know, trying to replicate the magic of White Men Can't Jump, Money Train, which came out in 1995. These weren't hits. They didn't do that well. So he's perhaps looking for something to put him back on top. And he's a big comic book movie guy. And he's a big comic book guy. And for years he had been trying to make Black Panther. And he'd been trying to get that off the ground. And couldn't. And then someone said, hey, take a look at this Blade thing. And it was the thing, I think, Goyer's script was already knocking around Hollywood at that point as well. And so the you know, it was a marriage made in heaven in a way. I mean, there's obviously a lot has happened to Mr. Snipes since.
Yeah.
That has made him something of a bit of a figure of fun. Unfairly so, I think, in terms of his ability as an actor. There are certain off-screen things that are perhaps best not dwelt on. Mm. But as an actor, as a purely charismatic force of nature, he is the real deal. And in Blade, he found his role, I think. You know, again, you know, I was a Wesley Snipes guy, you know, always bet on black is one of the greatest phrases in movie history from a terrible film, but there you go. You know, I liked him a lot, but I went to this with a degree of skepticism, and the minute he appears in the opening nightclub sequence is just, oh, this is a movie star. This is what movie stars do. This is what they look like. They you know, they can control the way they move. They can control the way they look in a way that you or I, not to diss you guys. and he's just coolness personified. He's like the Fonz turned up to 1,000 in this movie. He's ultra fucking cool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, no, I mean, they couldn't, I mean, obviously, I think it's reported David Goyer had him in mind when he was writing this, but it was the absolute perfect role for him. And just, I mean, the way that he plays it out, he almost said like, oh, he just sort of played out as a bad guy in sort of black. So I don't think there's ever been, well, sort of more perfect casting apart from Robert Downey Jr. maybe in Iron Man. There's never been a more like, that is the absolute nuts of casting straight away there.
Absolutely. It's one of those things within the first 3 minutes tells you, even though it's all action, tells you everything you need to know about this guy. This guy who is so cool that he can walk into an entire nightclub of vampires and they shit their pants
at the mere thought.
The Blade, you know, the Daywalker is amongst him. And, you know, I'd seen Passenger 57. I'd seen Demolition Man. I knew he could do action, but I didn't know he could do action. And this is the movie. I think he really wanted something that would showcase his ability as a martial artist. And there's stuff in this movie, you know, even years from now, my wife loves this film as well. And even years from now, if we find ourselves watching it on TV, we'll watch it to the very end, because there's stuff that happens in the final fight scene that I think is absolutely up there in terms of just terms of American action movies in general. There's stuff he does. There's you know, there's cool moves, funky moves, some incredible kills that he pulls off. It's just, you know, probably says a lot about me that I enjoy it, but it's
glorious to watch.
He's just tremendous. And then when he's talking, you know, when he doesn't speak a lot, obviously, but when he talks, you know, there's not many actors on the planet who can get away with saying things like, you know, there's worse things out tonight than vampires. Like what? Like me. And get away with it and mean it. But he's just great in this.
Just great.
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy to read out the lines in this film, and just the cheese factor is off the scale. Like, unbelievable so. But it works for him saying it. And I don't think there's ever, like, you know, you can't underestimate how much he formed the character to the point now that the comic book is basically Wesley Snipes, his Blade. Like, before this film and stuff, it was quite a garish character when it first started off. But, you know, the sort of, like, his costume, his mannerism, is this whole entire look is now replicated in the comic book itself.
Absolutely. And I listen, Mahershala Ali is an incredible actor. He is a fantastic actor. He has two Oscars to prove it. But I don't know. I don't know if he can fill Lee's shoes. I really don't. I hope he can. And he's a very, very cool dude. And I look forward to him high-kicking the shit out of vampires and proving me very, very, very wrong. But there's something about Wesley Snipes in this role that is just, it's just perfect synchronicity. It's just, it's fantastic. You know, he delivers, for my money, one of the greatest lines in the history of cinema, and just does it with a straight face. Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill. I mean, my God. I mean, that just knocks Nobody's Perfect into a a cocked hat, doesn't it?
He could have gone with, some people just want to push gravy up a hill with their nose. That's got the same kind of feel to it, but that's...
Yeah, then he would have had to explain what gravy is.
he's got a sense of humour as well. You could have seen, like, most recently he's been in the Expendables movie where he's taking the mickey out of his prison sentence and stuff like that. He's reprised his role in What We Do in the Shadows as well, hasn't he? On webcam to the Vampire League, which I thought was amazing. And I think apparently that took a little while for them to pull off.
Isn't the story that he wanted to be called Blade, or that he likes people to call him Blade. Even now, if you're like, so he's doing the role, and, you know, this is possibly an apocryphal tale, so I'm gonna preface it with all those disclaimers. This may not be true. But I have heard that he likes to be called Blade. And that's a character thing. That's a method actor thing. That's cool. That means that he's completely 100% immersed in the character. But it also means, in a way, that he doesn't, it's a bit sad really, but I feel like he's not quite ready to let go of the character. That maybe if he, you know, if he had his day in the sun, because he can, because he's a daywalker,
then
he'd like to play the role again. Could I think he's been very gracious about Mahershala Ali taking the role, as far as I know.
Could he take on the role as Whistler?
Oh, now you're talking, but surely that's Eddie Vedder's role, isn't it?
Eddie Vedder.
You know.
Right, so it's either Eddie Vedder or the guy from The Crash Test Dummies, one of the two.
Yeah.
Oh, him. Imagine Eddie Vedder making mass weapons of vampire destruction. He'd try and invite them round and sort it all out.
Yeah, he's a lover, not a fighter, isn't he?
Yeah.
No, I can absolutely. I think he'd make Pearl Jam.
What's this red stuff? That's Pearl Jam. Don't worry about it.
Don't ask.
But yeah, no, I listen. It's recorded. I've said it. So, you know, call me. If it happens, you can say you heard it here first.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay.
It's almost definitely going to be some sort of cameo, right? It's the thing, isn't it? Really?
Or Wesley. I mean,
yeah. No. But
I can always imagine it to be like, you know, one of those awkward scenes in Extras where they kind of invite him on to do his cameo and then they sort of turn around and he's there in full Blade gear. No, Wesley, we just need you to walk past in the background and maybe do the sunglass thing.
I'm going to kill those guys.
Don't call me Wesley. Oh, God.
There's Costa coffee cup with Blade written on it.
We talked about the cast. I just want to go back to it, because it's a bit of a sausage fest in a way, isn't it, this movie?
You said that, but Karen, the character, Dr. Karen.
And Busher Wright, if I pronounce her name right.
Yeah, lead sort of thing. And way ahead of the time.
Okay.
But yeah, apart from that.
it's a big old swinging sausage fest. There's Sana Lathan as his mum. So you have the really uncomfortable scene where she basically comes onto her son, which is really weird and creepy and like, oh God. He rebuffs her advances. But yeah, I think Busher Wright is really great in this. And, she's smart. She's capable. She gets her own storyline, which is interesting. She gets her own action stuff to do as well. Mm. Yeah, there's a little damsel in distress thing going on, but at the same time, she's also doing her own thing. And she's the one who really facilitates Blade coming back, because he gets his ass kicked and in the last third of the movie, and she saves him. She saves the day.
See, that's the way he saves her, by throwing her out of the window. I mean, if ever I'm going to save someone, that's the way I want to save someone.
That's what Blade does, man.
Matt, you wouldn't be able to pick me up, dude. I mean, that would be
hard. I just kind of lean you against the window and you slowly squeak down it.
That's not how you... This is not what is happening in my mind. So, I mean, we've got a lot to look forward to if we ever get out of sort of isolation, that potentially when we go back to things as they were, that we're going to get the Blade remake, and that's got something to look forward to. And I think it's going to, personally, I think it's going to work. I think it's, yes, it's a great casting and interesting to see if they just, hopefully just don't do a complete retelling of the original story, but they do something potentially a little bit differently with it, and that Marvel maybe go out of the way to make something that's a little bit feisty and rude.
It's the remake under the Marvel Studios.
Yes.
They got Morbius, haven't they, which is going to be, Sony, because it's Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Was meant to be the original villain in this, but they couldn't get the clearance because obviously, like you mentioned earlier, Marvel sold off various, not just characters, but entire universes with characters in them. So, because Sony got the Spider-Man, they held the rights to Morbius, so they couldn't use him.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So this is a New Line movie, just to show how widespread the rights issues were with Marvel. So the first thing out of the gate is a New Line movie in 1998. Then X-Men's a Fox film in 2000. Then Spider-Man Sony film 2003. Daredevil's Fox in 2002. Then 2003 you have Daredevil, which is a Fox movie, and they were just all over the shop. Universal was Hulk. In fact, Universal still part owns Hulk, which is one of the reasons why we haven't got a new solo Hulk film. It's just the rights. It's worse than the person. It's worse than people who turned down the Beatles. It's worse than the publishing companies that turned down J.K. Rowling before she got a deal. Mm. Whoever it was responsible for selling off the keys to the kingdom needs to be slapped. Mm. In a sort of very nice back of the hand kind of way, obviously, but it's one of the great sort of business shoot yourself in the foot situations. It's mad.
Mark Strong in Rock and Roller saying "give him a slap" sprang to mind there.
Another great film.
But I mean, like, whoever done that, so they do need a proper slap though, because they're responsible for all of the Fantastic Four films, whoever sold those rights. And the fact that they keep just bubbling it up to keep hold of the rights is why we keep getting such terrible ones after terrible ones.
Yep, but
slap.
They're coming back though. They will be coming back along with a real proper slap.
Proper slap.
So furry side.
or the hard side. This film made money ultimately, and that's why we got a sequel, but despite the sort of lukewarm response from the critics. And it was a reasonable length. It was 120 minutes. Although apparently it's a cut version of 110 minutes, but it's in colour, which is
they've added 10 more minutes to the uncut version.
The budget was 45 mil, and it made cumulative worldwide gross was 131 eventually after everything else. But so, that's why we've got the sequel and a much better sequel. Well, debatable, I suppose, but the sequel is enormous fun, and I think a little bit better than this movie, personally. That's what I think anyway. There you go. That's my opinion.
That's my thing anyway. And fuck you if you don't agree with me. I'll fight you.
this is the only place I've got power, is you know, in the house. It's having my opinion and having other 40-year-old men agree with me or disagree with you, but be polite about it. I mean,
well, if we're going to get polite about it, I would say with respect, fuck you.
I love Blade 2. I think it's fantastic, but I don't think it's as good as this one. Because it's just, even though it's got that sort of weirdly perverse Guillermo del Toro touches, it also feels just a little bit like a facsimile of the first one. But it's got some great stuff. The Blood Pack, the group of vampires that come together to team up with Blade, are really, really cool. But the central love story is a little bit wishy-washy. But yeah, when Blade's doing his thing on screen, it's tremendous. But when he's doing his thing on screen in this movie, it's, you know, you can't see me, but I'm kissing a chef right now. It's just great. There's a bit in the towards the end of this movie when he's fighting an army of anonymous vampire henchmen, and he breaks a dude's leg in a way that simultaneously makes me go, oh, but also, it's really, really badass.
It's the worst kind of fireworks display, kind of, you want to see.
Yeah, oh, ah! So it's really cool, but it takes your eye out. It's one of those.
Basically, it's choreographed most of the fights, right? Or if not all.
He did, yeah. Yeah, or at least, you know, so the legend says.
Shows you how much of an evil bastard that he really is, like, deep down. If that's what he's dreamt up. It's like, I know a really cool way of breaking a guy's leg. Watch this.
Yeah, precisely.
It's one of those things, like, when he pops up in an Expendables movie and you think, actually, you could probably just kill all the Expendables with like, one finger. Maybe not Jet Li. He's fine, you know.
And like in Blade, it'll turn to dust as well.
Indeed.
Now that was kind of Buffy-esque as well, wasn't it? That was very much in Buffy territory, where the vampires just disintegrated into dust.
But what came first, though?
Pretty sure Buffy came first. I'm pretty sure, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they both had the idea equally. But there's some really cool touches in this. So there's the idea of the vampires who are using basically factor 5,000 sunblocks so they can go out in the daytime.
I'm a ginger man, and I'm doubting that because
I'm Irish, mate.
I've got the toughest sunblock there is, and I still burn.
A red-headed Irishman, that must be the original vampire in a way. It's just like,
Jesus Christ, the sun. I know I need to get away from that fecker. It's going to reduce me to dust. But you also have the idea of, you know, the vampires at the end when they die, their skeletons rip themselves out of their body and then fly off into the night. It's just a lovely visual. Really, really bad CG, I have to point out. You know, that's one of the flaws of the movie. It's cheap as chips, and it shows it at times. But just lovely ideas. There's just these really, really fun little touches all the way through.
And I doubt if bone wings would really create enough downforce, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're not supposed to think about that, Matthew. It's called poetic license.
The other thing that was—it's what I get weird stuff stuck up in my head. It's like at the start, there's one of the vampire women, Mercury, maybe, I don't know, but she's always wearing white and a bra. That's kind of her thing.
Okay,
cool.
Because a lot of the vampires have uniforms, right? They have kind of clothes that they wear throughout the whole film. In fact, everyone in this film wears the same clothes throughout the whole entirety of the film.
I must stink.
She's wearing white, and she knows it's going to be a blood thing, and I'm like, you wouldn't do that. And then later on, she's wearing the same thing again. I'm like, either she's got bloody good washing powder, or just multiples of the same outfit.
Yeah,
it was confusing me, and I was perplexed.
Albert Einstein did that, didn't he?
Sorry.
Albert Einstein did that. When I say Albert Einstein did that, what I mean is he had multiple copies of the same clothes. He didn't go to vampire raves.
Well, you don't know this. Well, on that bombshell, Chris, is there anything else you want to say to defend this? You don't need to defend it.
This is one of the greatest movies ever made, isn't it? I mean, I'm really notching it up. I'm really turning it up. It's gone from 55% Rotten Tomatoes to the greatest movie ever made in the space of less than an hour. No, this is a fantastic film, and I will literally fight, but from a distance, socially responsibly, anyone who says otherwise. It's just tremendous. It's a great vampire movie. It's a great superhero movie. It's a great Wesley Snipes movie. He's badass. He's the king of cool. And it's just great.
Well,
nailed it.
Matthew, you agree with that, I guess?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with this film. And like any film which you can then trace the entomology all the way up through to all of the, you know, Marvel films to today. And, you know, there is a brilliant argument for saying if there was no Blade, there would be no Endgame and everything else. It's just, you know, you can't doubt the importance of this film.
Well, I agree with both of you, so that's good. And for both reasons and all the reasons you've said. So, yeah, the Blade original movie is definitely not a bunker movie, despite the tomato meter splat that it's received unjustly. So, yeah, we're jettisoning it out. We'll pop it out in the tube. Off it goes, virtually. And it will land on someone's DVD shelf or a VHS or whatever they prefer to watch or stream it. And they go, oh, yes, this is brilliant. And then it will go from there. So, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on to defend this movie.
Likewise. Didn't need much defending, though, did it?
What can we hear you, I say not see you, but hear you doing next? What's on your horizon?
People can hear me in a new service I'm doing where I creep into one person's room every night and, you know, just stay in their wardrobe for a good 3 or 4 hours. You can hear me breathing heavily. Don't need to apply for that
That's
service.
What that was.
I will just randomly turn up in someone's house and do that. It's the
Blue Velvet special, I call it. And
alternatively, you can hear my voice, my beautiful soothing Irish tones, on the Empire podcast every single Friday, and also specials and whatnot as well, whenever I can be arsed.
Perfect. Thank you again so much, Chris, for coming on the podcast, and hopefully we'll have you back again soon at some point.
Muchas gracias, as Blade might say.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this. Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian.
I love Blade!
Well, a great chat, and thanks to Chris again for coming on the show. We really enjoyed that one because it was a real deep dive.
I can't help but feel that we weren't our normal balanced self. Normally we try and find both sides of the argument and at least try and strip our guests down a peg or two of their films, but it's just not possible with Blade. It's brilliant, and I was very surprised, as I said in the interview, to find that it was as lowly rated as it was.
Yeah, it's a shocker. So I guess if you enjoyed the podcast, if you're new to it, then please subscribe. That would be fantastic on any device that you have. Write us a review, leave us a rating. It helps us climb the ladder and fight for survival in the film podcasts that are out there in the world. Yeah, and follow us on social media. We have a website too, don't we, Matthew?
We do. It's moviebunkerpodcast.com.
Magnificent. So in these dark times, Matthew, we should just bunker down and wait till it all blows over.
Yeah, or we could get sucked off by a vampire and then it wouldn't matter.
Yeah. Oh, I dream of these things. Cheerio.
Get your faggy chops around that.